This is Live at Politics and Prose, a program from Slate and Politics and Prose Bookstore in Washington, D.C., featuring some of today's best writers and top thinkers.
It is my pleasure to introduce Yaa Jassy, here today for her much-lauded, and deservedly so, debut novel, Homegoing. Homegoing begins in 18th-century Ghana with the stories of Essie and Effia, two sisters whose lives and those of their descendants take widely different paths, as one is sold into slavery across the Atlantic, and the other is married off to the white British governor, facilitating the trade for the British. Both sisters and their descendants are nonetheless scarred by the slave trade, each generation bearing in some form the wounds of the former and the legacy of slavery. It's an ambitious debut, delivered in gorgeous arresting prose, and one that has captured a lot of attention, including those of the staff here, many of whom I've seen toting their own copies of the book. It is therefore with great pleasure that we welcome Yaa Jassy to Politics and Prose. She'll be in conversation with Darlene Parkins Valdez, New York Times bestselling author of Wench and Bam. Please join me in welcoming Yaa Jassy to Politics and Prose.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
Welcome. If you are in the bookstore right now, please, you are in for a treat with this woman sitting right next to me. This debut novel is absolutely phenomenal. It is probably the best novel I've read in the last 5 years, and I read a lot. So this is a real treat to be sitting here next to you.
Thank you.
You're here. This is the woman. Now, please just remind us how to pronounce your name, because we all want to be able to spread the word about you and say it correctly.
So my first name is Yaa, and my last name is Jassy.
Yeah, that's helpful, right? Yeah, that's helpful. Yaa Jassy.
Yes.
That's easy. We can do that. And does Yaa have a meaning?
Yaa is an Akan name for girl born on Thursday.
Okay. Well, welcome to Washington. She said this is only her second time here.
Yeah,
so
thank you.
Welcome to D.C. I know I just was telling Yaa in the back room that most everyone here will not have read the book, and so I am a big believer in not spoiling the book. I don't even read reviews before. I like to open a book and not even know what it's about. So I'm going to be very careful today not to reveal any spoilers, okay? Because I'm like, I told her, I said, I'm an old-fashioned reader. I read for the story, so imagine that. And so we're gonna talk about the book, but we're going to talk about it kind of in general terms. Is that okay with y'all? Okay. But, you know, I'll just say that it is phenomenal. I woke up in the morning and started it one morning, and I did not put it down until the very end. I couldn't stop reading it. So as Noma said in her introduction, this is a big epic novel spanning about 300 years. The very beginning of it starting in the 1760s in West Africa in the Ashanti region. Goes all the way through the present. It absolutely sort of connects, I felt for me, so many holes between the African slave trade and African-American culture and people today. And so for me, it was a real, I don't like to speak of novels as sort of sociological, but I did feel like it was a real education for me. But it also sort of got into my heart and my soul. I wanted to start by asking you about your inspiration for writing the novel. I heard that it was a visit to the castle. Can you tell us about that moment, and also tell us a little bit about the castle for people here who might not know?
Sure. So this novel started for me in 2009. I received a grant from Stanford University to travel to Ghana and conduct research for a novel. And I'd had kind of a different idea in mind. I wanted to write something about mothers and daughters. My own mother is a Fanti, and she's from the central region. And so I kind of wanted to visit that area. I had never been there before and kind of experience it. But that idea wasn't really panning out. And a friend came to visit. And on a whim, we decided to go to the Cape Coast Castle, which I had also never visited before. And it was pretty much instantaneous. Once I got in the castle, I knew that this was where my novel was going to take place, going to center around. It was while on the tour of this castle that the tour guide started to tell us about how sometimes the British soldiers who lived and worked in this castle would marry the local women. And then the children from these unions would be sent off to school in England, and then they kind of came back and started to form Ghana's middle class. And then from there, he took us down to see the dungeons. And, you know, there's nothing that I can really compare that experience to, kind of thinking about how there would be Ghanaian women above living with their white British husbands, maybe not completely aware of what was to become of the women below who were about to be sent on through the Middle Passage. And I was really struck by the juxtaposition of that. To talk a little bit about the castle, it's in Cape Coast in the central region, what is now the central region of Ghana. It's majestic, it's beautiful, a large white structure with cannons that face out to the sea, and there's a church and all of this stuff on the top. And it was really just the seat of British colonial power in what was then the Gold Coast. And there was a lot of trade happening in this castle, trade of all kinds, textiles and food and then slaves, which was the big business at that time. And so a lot of different people and things were passing through the castle. It's still there. You can visit it for yourself. I think I went the summer that Obama went. So we were there kind of just a week apart, maybe. And it's a really powerful place and a really powerful experience.
Yeah, you know, I've heard from people who visited that you can still feel the spirits of the people there, that it's something sort of uncanny, but the weight of that spiritual presence is still there. Did you experience that?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I left thinking if there's any place in the world that's haunted, it's this. You know, how many people died down there in those dungeons? It's hard to imagine. It's hard to imagine being kept in a place that small with no light and no air and very little food. I mean, I don't know. I immediately sensed kind of a spiritual presence. Yeah.
And there is one scene early in the novel where one of the wives, the black Ghanaian wives, it wasn't Ghana yet, right? But who's married to the governor, hears someone crying or hears the sound of crying, and she gets down on the floor and puts her ear. She doesn't know that there are people under
right.
there, and she can hear the people. And when she says something to her husband about it, he shushes her violently a little bit
right.
and scares her, and she knows not to ask him again.
Right, right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm sure there was an awareness of what was going on. I'm not trying to say they didn't know what was happening. But, you know, I think, you know, Ghanaians, we have these monuments to slavery all over our land, and yet we didn't get to see the result of it. You know, we didn't get to see what happened when people were sent away. And so, you know, now if you go visit the castle, I think you get that fuller picture, especially if you grow up here and have this kind of connection to the legacy of slavery that African Americans have, that Americans have.
Yeah, and what's so wonderful about you telling this story, Yah, is that there's a real focus in the early chapters of the novel on the experience of women in there, and you all can just imagine, you know, what horrors happened to the women there. And Isabel Wilkerson reviewed her book for the New York Times, cover of the New York Times book review tomorrow, I think.
Yay.
Yeah, that's right, tomorrow.
Check it out. But in the very first paragraph of the review, she says she remembers her own visit with a group of scholars to the castle. And she said that they, you know, went through, and then finally the tour guide brought them to the grave of one of the governors, or mm-hmm. the governor. I don't know if there was more than one.
There were more than
there
one.
There was more than one, okay. So to the grave of one of the governors, and she says one of the professors, an even-tempered professor, steps forward and spits on the grave. And she said the tour guide sort of hung back and allowed them to experience their grief. And I thought, you know, wow, what a moment to be there. I mean, here we are 300 years later, and yet we still feel the pain of what happened there.
Right. Absolutely. I think it's hard, you know, it's hard to erase that pain, especially since so little, I think, has been done to kind of make amends for the situation. I think, you know, if you go visit, you would feel all of the rage and the grief and just, you know, just not understanding how something like this could happen on such a large scale for so many hundreds of years.
You know, I was just telling Yaa, I wasn't sure if she knew this, but Roxane Gay, one of my friends and who most of us know as a really sharp writer and cultural critic, recently said that she believes your novel is the strongest case for reparations she has ever read. And I thought, wow, that's a powerful statement. But yet, while the novel has these representations of injustice and even representations of bitterness, it isn't a bitter novel. It isn't a novel that points fingers. Did you consciously think about the kinds of emotional demands you were making on the reader in terms of these injustices?
Yeah, I did. You know, I didn't want this to be a novel that kind of ascribed blame on any one party. I wanted it to kind of show the complexity of the situation. You know, people were exploiting other people. Ghanaians were exploiting other people, but they were also at the same time being exploited. And I think this is a novel where there and a situation where there are no villains, there are no heroes. You know, it's kind of this nuanced representation of how people come to evil circumstances and how they behave in those circumstances. You know, the slave trade happened to people like us. It didn't happen to some nameless, faceless mass. It happened to people who had hopes and dreams and fears and all of those things that we have. And so when you think, how could someone do something like this? You're also thinking about yourself, you know? And so I wanted to bring that to the book.
Yeah, there's a line in there where James, he's African, but he's been named after, he's half, he's been named after his European father, he says to the village, to his village, he says, everyone was responsible. We all were, we all are. And I think that was maybe what you were getting at. Do you feel that sort of in a general sense, that when something like this happens, we all bear some responsibility?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you have to wonder, like, what would have happened if the different ethnic groups in West Africa had banded together against these European forces. You know, it's just hard. It's hard to say that any one person or any one group of people were to blame, or any one group of people were virtuous. You know, it's just this. It was a thing that was fed by greed on multiple different sides. And I think that's what James is getting at. You know, we all have this responsibility to stop this sooner than we did.
I wanted you to talk to us, because like I said, most of us haven't read the book yet here, about the Ashanti Kingdom. I'm really interested in the research that you did for the novel. The location of that empire was strategic. Why? And also, tell us just, like, if you can, a little bit, because the book really references a lot of history. Mm-hmm. And the American history, of course, you know, I was more familiar with. But the African chapters of the novel were new for me. And you reference, I think, the War of the Golden Stool. Mm-hmm. So can you just sort of give us a sort of abbreviated timeline of what we're talking about in this novel? We're starting in the 1660s. We go all the way up through independence. Mm-hmm. Is there any way you could do that to just help us out?
I'll try.
I know that's a big question. 300 years of Ghanaian history in 2 seconds. Go.
Let's see.
It would be helpful to just get like the frame.
Sure.
So and also, just tell us how you did your research. We would love to hear that.
Okay. So the Ashanti live in the inland of Ghana. They're kind of in the centrally located. And they were an incredibly powerful kingdom. I think one that was feared by not just other ethnic groups in the West Coast of Africa, but also by the Europeans. There were several Anglo-Ashanti wars up until the last one in 1900, which was the War of the Golden Stool, or the Ya-Santwa War, which is the war that we finally, the Ashanti, lost and ended up being, you know, absorbed into the British colony finally.
That was 1900.
That was 1900, but they resisted that for hundreds of years and won several wars against the British before that. And so their part in the slave trade kind of centered around them, you know, kind of selling their captives from their own wars. And then the Fanti, who lived on the coast, acted as kind of a trading, location. So people would be brought down to the coast and the Fanti would sell them to the British or the Dutch or whichever European party kind of had control of that area at the time.
So they're raiding each other's villages, and then when they would win a raid, they would take captive some of the people of the village they had raided, and then they would sell the captives from the village they had raided to the Europeans.
Right, exactly. That's kind of the basics of how that worked.
Yeah.
I went about my research. So after that trip to Ghana in 2009, I started with a book called The Door of No Return by William St. Clair. It came out, I think, in 2009 or 2007, not too long ago. But it's a book that kind of takes you through the Cape Coast Castle. It has a chapter on the women, a chapter on the soldiers, a chapter on, you know, kind of the layout. And it really helped me wrap my head around what it might, you know, be like to live and work in the castle during that time. The unfortunate aspect of that book for me, I thought, was that it didn't have really a section from the perspective of the people who would have been kept in the dungeons. It was kind of really, missing that voice. And so this novel kind of felt to me like a project in restoring that voice and kind of imagining my way into some of the people who weren't allowed to speak for themselves in that time. You know, the British brought the written language with them to Ghana, and so there were a lot of stories that were never told from our side of the line. So I started with that book, and then I wrote the first two chapters pretty much right away. And then after that, I made a family tree that I put on the wall of my apartment above my desk, and it just had either sister on either side, and then their names if I knew it, gender if I knew it, and then also the time period during which the bulk of their chapter would be taking place, and then maybe just one thing that was going on politically, historically during that time period. So the advent of cocoa farming in Ghana, or the Great Migration, or the Fugitive Slave Act, whatever it was. And so then I wrote chronologically, and once I got to a chapter, the beginning of a chapter, I would stop and do a little research about whatever it was I'd put in the background of that section. So books like The Fanti and the Transatlantic Slave Trade by Rebecca Shumway, or Black Prisoners in Their World by Mary Ellen Curtin, just enough to kind of spark my imagination. And once that had happened, I would close the book and move on. But the research, I really wanted it to feel like it was opening me up and not stifling me. So I didn't want this book to feel stiff with research. You know, I wanted you to still get a sense of the characters and the emotional aspect of the book. But
So that's really interesting that you had this sort of genealogical chart, because, you know, the book, y'all, follows two lines of a family. One line stays in Africa for the most part, mm-hmm. and the other, which comes across on one of those slaving trips. Ships. And so that brings us to, like, the structure of the book. So the book has 14, I think, point of view characters. 14?
Yes.
14 point of view characters, each in separate sections. How did you manage that, and how did you decide upon that as a structuring device?
Yeah, when I initially thought of this book, I knew that I wanted it to end in the present, and I knew that I kind of wanted it to be about the present situation. I wanted to talk about kind of the African immigrant to America and the African American. So that was my initial idea. And I thought I would just set the book in the present and then flash back to 18th century Ghana in these brief moments. And then the more I thought about it and the more I wrote, I realized that what I was much more interested in was kind of being able to look at something move and change very subtly over a very long period of time. In this case, that something was slavery and colonialism. And in order to do that and kind of have people feel, you know, the weight of that, I felt like it would make more sense to have as many pit stops in the decades between then and now as possible. So that's how I came upon the structure. It is, you know, it's not a typical structure for a book. And so, you know, it had certain challenges about how to make something cohere. Usually when you get a multi-generational family story, there aren't as many characters, first of all, and it doesn't cover as much time. And so there were certainly challenges to it, but it felt important to me that by the time you got to the present, you completely understood how and why everything was happening, you know, politically, historically, to those characters who lived in present-day America.
And did you think of it, I mean, I didn't read them as short stories, yeah. But did you think of them as individual short stories? I mean, they do all have their own narrative arc, yeah. Each chapter. But did you think of them as, like, short stories?
No, I never thought of them as short stories. You know, the book always felt novelistic in scope to me, and also because I had that large timeline in mind, it always felt, like, very complete and holistic to me. I understand that the chapters are discrete enough that they can be read alone, and they can also be read, you know, two at a time, or however it is that people want to read it. But for me, the point of the book is what it all looks like together, which is why I felt like it was a novel.
I agree. I mean, as I read it, one of the things that was kind of fun is as you began each chapter to figure out how this character was connected to the characters you'd already given before. And typically you drop those hints about the second page, you'd start to understand the puzzle. It's the book that feels like a puzzle.
Yeah. Yeah. I wanted it to feel like the kind of novel that accumulates, you know, so each generation gets a little richer. The feeling of reading it gets a little richer as you go along. And by the end of it, you know, you have this big bag full of every character that's come before.
And yeah, I'm like so in awe. I mean, it's such an ambitious structure, such an ambitious novel. Did you ever feel, as you were structuring it this way with the 14 points of view and the 14 sort of chapters, did you ever second guess yourself? Did you ever think, like, maybe I need to just scratch that and write it in a kind of traditional way? And then you couldn't because it just worked better this way?
Yeah. Well, I started it in a traditional way, and that wasn't working. So this felt like the better option. I'd written probably about 100 pages or so by the time I got to Iowa for grad school. And then I ended up throwing out all of those pages and starting on this new path with the new structure because I felt like it just suited my ideas a lot better than a traditional structure. And, you know, it was the kind of thing where I couldn't tell whether or not it was going to work until I finished a first draft, which isn't, like, a fun position to be in as a writer if you spend, you know, 7 years on something and then you're like, oh, well, maybe it doesn't work, so I have to throw it out. So luckily for me, it went okay when I read that first draft. But I just felt like I had to at least try it and see if it was a possibility.
7 years for the first draft, is that what you just said?
It was probably 5 years for the first draft.
Oof. How long in all did it take you to write this?
Like 6.5, 7 years in all.
Okay, so once you had that first draft, then you kind of, once you knew it was working, then you kind of were able to move forward a little more quickly.
Yeah, then I started to revise, which was a lot more fun. Yeah.
Wow, okay. 7-year first draft, y'all. Okay, and so let me ask you. So one of the things that I really loved about your expertise as a writer is that you were equally comfortable with the African scenes of the novel. Like, you had clear authority over everything Ashanti. I thought you knew the language, you knew the poetry, you knew the fables, you knew the landscape, you knew what kinds of flowers grew there, you knew what they were eating, you knew how to make fufu, you knew everything.
Yeah.
And yet then when the chapters are in the African American section, I was bracing myself. I said, can she do it? And I'm not kidding. And you had slave dialectical speech. You nailed it. You understood Baltimore culture. You know, there's Baltimore scenes there. Now, so tell us a little bit about your background. You grew up in Huntsville. You were born in Ghana. How old were you when you came here? I'm just trying to figure out everything about you. that basically.
So I was born in Ghana. I was born in Mampong, Ghana, in the Ashanti region, and lived there until I was 2 and a half. And then we lived in Ohio, Illinois, Tennessee, and then Alabama. Alabama when I turned 9, or the summer I turned 10, so I was 9 years old. I think, you know, I kind of grew up in between cultures, like not feeling totally Ghanaian enough for Ghanaians and also not feeling totally African American enough when I was here. And so I feel like this book really, really is just like the physical representation of me straddling those two worlds and trying to navigate those two worlds and figure out what the connections were between them and what the conversation was between us as Africans and African Americans. And so, you know, I don't think I would have written this book if I hadn't grown up in Alabama and kind of seen the way that the legacy of slavery still affects states like Alabama. And I don't think I would have written this book if I hadn't been born in Ghana and you know, experienced that side of things. So I think this book really is kind of the culmination of all of my experiences in that way.
Now, when it came to sort of slave speech and all that, did you have to, like, because people ask me how I research, I'm like, oh, I just remember how my grandmother talked.
Yeah.
Did you, I mean, I know Huntsville is definitely, you know, it's some Southern stuff going on down there. you can't get more Southern. But did you have to, like, did you get somebody to read it, check it over for you? Did you feel like you kind of had a handle on it?
I felt like I kind of had a handle on it. Just from listening, but also just reading other people's work helps a lot for that kind of thing. Because people make different choices in all of their the ways that they represent dialogue, African American vernacular, English, and in fiction. And so I kind of just tried to study all of those and pick one that felt like it worked for me.
And you said reading other people. Who influences you?
Oh, I adore Toni Morrison. Song of Solomon was a huge inspiration for me. It was the first book by a black woman that I had ever read, and it really just turned my life around, I think. I also love Edward P. Jones. I love Lost in the City is one of my favorite short story collections. James Baldwin is a big one. I grew up Pentecostal in the South, and I just love everything that he writes about religion. Jhumpa Lahiri. I have so many heroes. Yeah.
And I just dropped a couple of my cards. I'm picking them up. Oh, here's a question. Early on in the novel, and I just mentioned this to her, y'all know that my first novel was Wench. And she's got a paragraph on page 19 of her novel, y'all, that just made me just drop my coffee. She'd heard the Englishmen call them wenches, not wives. Wife was a word reserved for the white women across the Atlantic. Wench was something else entirely, a word the soldiers used to keep their hands clean so that they would not get in trouble with their god, a being who himself was made up of three but who allowed men to marry only one. I always thought wench was a word that didn't apply to black women until the Americas, but you saying it was already in use over in the castle.
Yeah, yeah. I didn't know that. I mean, I knew about the marriages between the British soldiers and the local women, but I had never heard that they termed them differently until I read that book, The Door of No Return by William St. Clair, where he had looked through kind of all of this archival data about the castle and the people who lived and worked in the castle. And he had a paragraph about why they called them wenches, which was something I had never heard of before. And I thought, you know, how fascinating that there's this entire separate term for your black wife. Yeah.
Wow. And to me, that, you know, one of the things I felt as I read this book was how all of our stories are so interconnected that we've all been trying to sort of piece together about the history of African Americans. But one of the things about your book is that you kind of piece it all together in one book. You know, I've been thinking of, like, how does Toni Morrison speak to Isabel Wilkerson, speaks to Ayanna Mathis, speaks to Angela Flournoy? Excuse me. I forgot my water. But one of the things that I really appreciate about your book is that you piece it all together. You somehow manage to create that tapestry all in one book. I mean, some of the things you touch on, and I'd just like to know, you said you had on your chart significant things, but some of the things you touch on are drug addiction, migration, coal mining. Tell me about blacks and coal mining. I never knew that we had a history of being coal miners.
Yeah, this was something that, that came up in my research as well. In the period after the Civil War had ended, it was not uncommon to arrest black men for things like vagrancy, which is just a word that means nothing. Basically, you could be standing on the street and get arrested for vagrancy. And then in certain southern states, they could sell these men to private companies, such as coal mines or railroad companies. So they would essentially, the state of Alabama would lease a man to the coal mining company for $18 a month or whatever it was. And it was the re-enslavement of black people, particularly black men, a totally legal form of re-enslavement after the Civil War had ended. And it's an aspect of our history that we very seldom talk about, but that I think, you know, considering things like mass incarceration today or the criminalization of black men today, I think we should be talking about how this system happened and how we started, we kind of started that in the period right after the Civil War.
So I, you know, when they arrest him, I think they're going to take him to a chain gang. I'd known about chain gangs, and that's right. In Morrison too.
Right.
But when they lower him into that mine, I'm kind of shocked.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then Platte City, was that a real place?
Pratt City. It was a real place. There's a place called Pratt City in the area that's now Birmingham. That was a kind of a coal mining town that these men had made up after they got out of the convict leasing system. And what was unique about this city was that it had whites and blacks living together, who kind of were creating this town together. But it has a really fascinating history, and one that I knew nothing about, even though I had grown up in Alabama. Yeah,
so it's this town where after they've been, they're ex-cons now, they have a hard time reintegrating into society, so they decide to just go back to the mines, and they create this coal mining community where now they are working for the mines for pay, very little pay, but for pay, and it's black and white cons together,
ex-cons.
And they form unions. That's all a real history.
Yeah, it's all real. There's a great book that I read for this part of the research called Black Prisoners in Their World by Mary Ellen Curtin. And she kind of talks all about what the city kind of was made of, and also just the process by which these men were arrested and leased.
How much more time do we have? Five minutes. Okay. Do we have questions too?
Yeah.
Okay. 5 minutes and then Q&A. Okay. Because I could sit here all day, y'all. When I was in college, there was a lot of talk about, like, how much African cultural retentions remained in African-American culture, you know, because in those days, so many of us were Afrocentric, and we really wanted to sort of find out what was African about us. Yours is a story of disruption in so many ways, because so much is lost, you know. And yet it also gives me hope that something has remained. What are your thoughts about African diasporic connections, about, you know, Black Americans returning to the motherland? I mean, do you have any thoughts about that?
I mean, diaspora is hugely important to me. You know, I was born in Ghana, but I grew up here, and my sense of myself, both ethnically and racially, was really complicated and kind of confused. Whenever we moved, when we lived in America, we would always move to predominantly white areas. And so I was kind of cut off from African-American culture entirely and was kind of learning it on my own, because there were things that my parents couldn't teach me about what it means to be Black in America. You know, they had a strong sense of themselves as Ghanaians, which me and my brothers didn't have because we didn't grow up there. And so I kind of left for college wondering a lot about diaspora and where I fit in diaspora. And in a lot of ways, that trip to Ghana in 2009 was about me getting a chance to reconnect to my roots and feel myself there around my family and kind of learn about what it was to be Ghanaian. And so I think diaspora is hugely important. It's hugely important to this book, obviously. One of the huge tragedies for me about the slave trade was the way in which it fractured these African American families so completely. You know, you could have your wife stolen off the side of the road and never see her again. And what did that mean for your family? You know, what did that mean for your future, for your legacy? And so many African Americans have experienced this fracturing. And not only do they not know where certain parts of their family ended up, but they also don't know where on the continent they came from. And that to me seems hugely tragic. You know, I got the chance to go back and experience what it was like to you know, be in Ghana and feel as though I was a part of that larger family. And not everybody gets that. And so I was thinking about this book as a way of kind of restoring that idea that we are a diaspora, that we are connected and a part of this kind of larger family, a part of this larger conversation, and that it's important to think about it that way.
Yeah, and the ancestry kits that people are taking now that kind of help us pinpoint a little bit closer, it's so profound for so many of my friends who have done it.
Absolutely.
I have a swab test at home. I haven't done it yet.
Oh,
I think
really?
I'm scared or something. I don't know. Maybe I'll find out I'm not who I think I am or something. You speak in the novel more than once about European Christianity's view of African religion as sort of voodoo or black magic.
Yeah.
Where it's a disruption where even something as seemingly innocent as the Anansi the spider fable is considered threatening.
Mm-hmm.
And later in the novel, even Black Americans hold this viewpoint. There's a couple of characters that are kicked out of the church because the grandmother is called a witch. And you have a quote in here. "The need to call this thing good and this thing bad, this thing white and this thing black, was an impulse Efia did not understand. In her village, everything was everything. Everything bore the weight of everything else."
Mm.
Talk to me about that in the novel, which I just thought was such a statement.
Mm. Well, religion has always been hugely important to me. I mentioned before that I grew up Pentecostal, and so it was a big part of my life. You know, I went to church multiple times a week. I was in the choir.
Now, does Pentecostal retain some African something? I know when I was growing up, that was one of those things that we talked about, like when you shouted and got spiritual in church, that was considered an African particular. But I don't know if that was a myth or not. Y'all know what I'm talking about?
Like
the sort of spiritual ecstasy that you saw more of, and the emotionalism that you saw more of in African-American churches, we typically attribute it to our African heritage.
Yeah.
Do
yeah.
you believe in that or no?
I think so, but I didn't go to a Black Pentecostal church. I went to
a
white Pentecostal church.
Oh.
So I don't think they were ascribing it to, you know, to anything.
Were they shouting in there?
They certainly shouted.
Yeah.
Yes. All of the above. But, you know, it was a different relationship to, you know, to religion than most Black people get. And then, you know, on the other side of things, I had a father who was kind of constantly whispering, well, you know, if the British hadn't come to Ghana, none of this would have, you know. And so I was like, my experience of religion was also tempered by my father's cynicism towards having the religion be a part of African life. And so I was thinking about that a lot when I was writing this book, both the ways that religion can bring joy and comfort and kind of restore things to you. There's a character in this chapter or in this book named Willie who goes to the church after having lost so much and she starts to sing, and it's this place where she feels great comfort. And I understand that, you know. But then there's another character named Akuia who's raised by a missionary, and she has a much more complicated relationship to religion. And so I kind of wanted to represent it in a lot of different ways, both as a source of joy and comfort, but also as a source of great trauma and kind of colonial power when you speak about it in Africa and other places. Yeah.
Well, we're going to open up questions. Oh, yeah, there's microphones on two sides. We just ask if you've read it. Don't spoil for the people who haven't.
I haven't read it. I've downloaded it. I'm eager to start.
Thank you.
I'm very interested in your family and why they came over to the U.S. and what all the movement was about, what kind of thing your parents were doing.
Sure.
And how they regard your novel.
So my father is a professor of French language and Francophone African literature, and we came to America so he could go to school. He was getting his PhD at Ohio State University, and we moved around a lot because he was looking for a tenure-track job, which is how we ended up in Alabama when I was 9. And so my parents still live there. My little brother still lives there, and it's kind of the place I think of as home. My parents have both read the book now. They hadn't, like, a few weeks ago. I was really shy about giving it to them. But, you know, I think they're really happy about it and really, really proud. And I think it's kind of started some conversations in our own family about, you know, kind of thinking more about diaspora than we were used to, I think. And so that feels like a positive thing to me. Yes.
Let me see if this is working. Is this working? Okay. So I'm from Ghana, too. And I connect with the comment you made about trying to balance your Ghanaian and African-American history.
Yeah.
One of the things, though, I think is true for this first generation is the fact that we are told to take safe jobs.
Mm.
And now that you're a writer, how do you think that the community and also your parents, do they take your career seriously or do they want you to have a very safe type of job because they didn't come over here just to see you be an artist?
Yeah. I think that might be word for word what my mother said to me.
So what is your advice for other, you know, immigrants, first gen, to really not be nurses and pharmacists and lawyers?
Yeah, my parents, it took a while for them to come around, you know, but I really do believe that James Baldwin quote that if you are meant to become a writer, there's nothing anyone can say that will stop you. And if you aren't meant to, then there's nothing anyone can say that's going to make you one. You know, I've known that I have wanted to do this my entire life, basically. And I understand where my parents' ambivalence was coming from. You know, you make such huge investments in your children, particularly when you're an immigrant and you kind of have given up everything to pour into your kids' lives and pour into your kids' education and all of this. And then, you know, to have a child come up to you and say, I don't care about money, I just want to be happy. It's frightening and shocking. And I think it took a while for my parents to get there. But now, you know, they're all acting like they've been there since day one. Very supportive. But, you know, just keep pushing and keep talking to them about why it's important to you. And you know, they love you and they will understand eventually.
Well, I have a safe job.
Oh.
But I work with younger people who definitely ask those questions.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Well, let them know.
Okay.
It's possible. It's possible to have a career in the arts and be an immigrant and be successful. And all of those things that they want for you, you can still have.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I'm really fascinated with your book. I'm just absolutely startled. I am reminded of a book that I heard about first here in 1998 called Slaves in the Family by Edward Ball. Edward Ball was a descendant of slave owners and slave traders and had records so that he could trace back an awful lot of information. And he chose to research six families, six black families who had grown up on plantations his family owned, one of which was my next-door neighbor's family. This is in South Carolina. But he said when he did this book, no matter where he went, whether he was talking to descendants of slaveholders in the United States, descendants of slave traders in England, or the descendants of people who sold, captured and sold slaves in West Africa, the same answer came. That was a long time ago. I had nothing to do with it.
Yeah.
Why are you bringing that up? So I think we're at a wonderful place now where we're asking this question from such different perspectives. And I believe that what you've done is, as the other young lady said there, is pull it together in a way that lets us see the whole fabric. And it's wonderful that it came out the same time the new version of Roots is out. Because this version, much more than the other version, talks about what happened in Africa.
Yeah. Thank you.
So I didn't really have a question. So but did you read Edward Ball's book on slaves and the family?
No, I did not.
I think you might find it interesting.
Thank you.
Hey, yeah, I'm first gen too. And I think this is an amazing book.
Thank you.
I'm totally into African lit and Black American lit because I'm in both worlds too.
Yeah.
And I've straddled that and had questions about it. It's amazing how you've been able to kind of truncate everything into this little book. Like,
yeah.
Centuries of history. And I'm wondering how much, like, but anyway, I'm excited to read the book.
Thank you.
I wanted to know how much research you did. You talked about getting the other side of the story from Africans and from Ghanaians. And I'm from Elmina.
Okay.
Right there.
Yeah.
But how did you get stories, like personal accounts? Because obviously written history wasn't kind of like our portion, but
right.
How did you talk to people, and what kind of stories did you get from people on the ground in Ghana about the experience?
Yeah, I didn't really like interview people or talk to people in that way, but I'd always had interest in these kind of whispered stories that have come up. Like my grandmother is from Kremense, which was one of the trading stops, and so that kind of is a part of my history. And I have family members with the last name York, and I was thinking, you know, what's that about? You know, and so I think this book was an investigation into those kind of stories that had been told in whispers, but I didn't seek it out. I didn't kind of try to delve into it any more than that, because I didn't want my imagination to be stifled by having to connect it to the truth of my family.
Yeah.
So I wanted this book to be a separate thing.
Okay.
So I don't know is the short answer, like what my family's story is in relation to this kind of thing, but I'm interested in it.
So do you think you'll write something eventually that has to do with maybe the Africans that sold people in the slave, like that story? Like, I feel like that's been told. It's been mentioned that Africans sold other Africans in slavery, but no one's kind of come out and said, you know, this is my history and I want to tell that story.
Right.
That would be interesting.
Yeah, it could happen. I don't know. I guess never say never.
I wonder if Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie, her book Americana, had any impact. You'd already started writing your book, but in terms of the articulation by an African woman writer on suddenly realizing there are differences between Africans and African Americans, and you alluded to that you're a first-generation immigrant, and that's a whole nother, people are learning a whole nother class of experience, I would say, from each of those. Can you make any observations on that or other African women writers?
Yeah, I was already pretty far into this book when Americana came out. I think it came out just about a year before I finished writing this novel. And I love Adichie. I've read all of her books, so I'm a big fan. And what excited me about Americana was that it was kind of one of the first books by one of these popular African immigrant writers to engage with diaspora in this way. And I was fascinated by it and really into the idea of opening up that conversation. My experience is different from Adichie's and Adichie's character, Efemelu, in that book, in that I came so young that I don't have a strong sense of myself as a Ghanaian. I think that book is a part of the conversation, and that there's more to come. You know, this book might be one part of that, and hopefully there will be even more books to follow, kind of just about the different ways that one can be a Black immigrant in America. And I'm excited to have those kinds of conversations.
Okay, we have time for one more question, they tell me. This lovely lady. Do you have a question, too?
No, I'm photo op.
Oh.
I was over here getting photos.
So my question is about your experience in grad school as a writer. So you said that you kind of trashed the first draft of this novel when you got to Iowa. And yeah. I'm wondering what the experience was like of writing this book while in grad school. Do you feel like being in a writing grad program allowed you the creativity to create this type of unconventional novel, or how do you feel like it affected your work?
I think the thing that Iowa gave me more than anything else was just endless amounts of time to work. You know, before I got to Iowa, I had a full-time job in San Francisco, and I was not working at all on my writing. And so I knew that I wanted to go to grad school really for the time and the, you know, not having to worry about money aspect of it. But at the same time, I did workshop parts of this book. I think I workshopped 3 or 4 chapters total. And I got a lot of readers that I still keep in touch with who I feel like really understand me and my work. And so those kinds of things were invaluable about it. But for me, it was really a matter of having had this idea for such a long time and not really having the time to devote to it and do it as much justice as I wanted to, and Iowa really provided that for me. Yeah.
In other words, she arrived already a genius. They just gave her some time. Thank you, you guys, really.
Thank you.
Buy this book.
Thank you so much. That was great.
Live at Politics and Prose is a co-production of The Bookstore and Slate.com. For information about upcoming Politics and Prose events, visit politics-prose.com. And please let us know what you think of this program. Our email is podcasts@slate.com.